This is Hearts of Oak podcast. Free speech, religious disagreement, children's rights, and open and free discussion on any topic are bedrock to a democratic free society, and we seek to promote and champion these basic rights. Join us. Let's keep the conversation going.
And Hearts of Oak, thank you so much for joining us once again for a interview on a topic we've actually only covered once. And I was chatting to Jeremy beforehand, and I don't know why I've only done it once with Lord Monckton, but it is a pleasure to have Jeremy Nibor joining us. Jeremy, thank you so much for your time today.
Well, glad to be on your show. Very kind.
Great to have you. And part of the reason why interviewing you is obviously your book, which has been sitting on my desk, Climate, All Is Well, All Would Be Well, published the end of last year. That is available, and the links are all in the description for people to get hold of. And also, we have an event coming up on Wednesday. Once again, the details are in the description in Wallingford Town Hall. Let me hold up. This is the poster that's gone around. Again, we'll put a link to that in the description. But it is an event looking at the issue of climate change and, I guess, challenging the narrative which we are all given, that how awful CO2 is and how we're all heating up, we're all going to die very, very soon. And you are going to give us a little bit of positivity to that negativity. But Jeremy, can I just first ask you to maybe introduce yourself to our viewers before we get into the topic?
Yeah, of course. I've been a lawyer all my life, so I'm not an expert in science or any other scientific-related subject. But I am a lawyer. I spent my life looking at evidence and assessing evidence and relying on evidence as best I possibly can. I got into the climate change thing in 2009. I went to a lecture in the Church House in London, and there was a chap called Professor Ian Plimmer there giving a talk. He was supposed to talk against a chap called George Monbiot of the Guardian, but he didn't turn up. But I was so impressed with what this chap said, Plimmer said, or Plimer, I think he's called, that I looked into it, and I was asked by the Bruges Group to prepare a paper on the EU and climate change and all the regulations that they were passing and have passed and still passing. So that's how I got into it. So when it came into this conference in Glasgow in October last year, it seemed to me absolutely essential that we ought to get a book out to explain to people exactly what climate change is and isn't. And so we got that book out fairly rapidly. It took 3 months to write, but it went to first bestseller on Amazon in ecology and climate change. And it did extremely well. And it's received a lot of attention, which has brought me somewhat into the focus, into the limelight, which I'm very pleased about, not for myself, but we have to get this message across to those who are governing us. And that's the aim of my second book, which is called CO2, Nature's Gift, which is being published finally today, being printed today. And the idea there is to get that to all the MPs and to those who have power over policy.
Well, I remember getting a hold of, probably about 6 or 7 years ago, of Christopher Booker's book on it. Yeah, wonderful book. Very large book as well. And I think one of the advantages of what you put together is it is, I think, maybe a little bit more accessible. It's also got all the backing to it. It's got all the graphs to it. And I think that is extremely helpful to the layperson.
You've got to do that. You've got to make it clear to people who can find this out for themselves, because that's the key. That's the absolute key, that people find out for themselves, that they don't bend their knee at some altar and say, tell us what the catechism is. It's to hell with that. They can find it on the internet. And Christopher Booker was brilliant at that. I thought a great deal of him. But I wanted to publish a book that was short, clear, had diagrams, and that people won't be frightened about.
Absolutely. Could we maybe touch on one of the first, and you start your book with this, looking at the great boogeyman, we're told, the great danger, which is CO2. We are this agenda of reducing CO2, of net zero, all of this. And CO2, we're told, is deadly. You take a very different position. Can you maybe explain to us why that is not correct?
Well, there are three things to say. The first is, does it trap heat? The second thing is, what's the record? Has CO2 been ever responsible for temperature rise? And the third thing is, what CO2 do for us as a race in terms of our life existence? And those are the three things. The first thing is, CO2 does not cause a heat trap or a blanket at all. It has no effect on temperature except to keep the temperature of the Earth at an average of 15 degrees centigrade, for which a water vapor is much more responsible than CO2. Those are the two most important trace gases, as we call them. But water vapor is 95% of the trace gases and has about 80% of the greenhouse effect. Now, the greenhouse effect simply is a slowing down of the escape to space of heat that's reflected off the surface of the Earth. Only 6% of the solar heat gets reflected back and is caught by these two gases. There are other gases, but they're very, very small and not worth mentioning. So that's what CO2 does. There is no trap, no blanket. As CO2 has got the same concentration right through the atmosphere, right up to 84 kilometers in the, where the atmosphere ceases. It has never had a trap or blanket. If I could mention the other one, the next point, temperature. CO2 has never, ever caused temperature rises in on the planet. In fact, if you look at the temperature in relation to CO2 content since 600 million years ago when multicellular life first appeared, you can see there's absolutely no correlation at all. In fact, there are times when the temperature was at its highest and CO2 was for millions and millions of years at its lowest. There's one period when it was down to 180 parts per million, which is only 30 parts per million above starvation levels because photosynthesis stops there. So we're told that there's CO2's risen and with it temperature has risen. That's not even true for the last 150 years. The 1930s was the highest period of heat in the planet, generally. But CO2 was scarcely accelerating. 1963 was the coldest winter since 1740. And that was when CO2 was shooting up. It's simply untrue. The temperature hasn't risen since 1998. In fact, it's fallen by 0.2 degrees. And since we've had satellite records, it's only gone up by 0.27 degrees. So that's that one. There's no connection whatsoever in science between increase of CO2 and temperature rise. And even if there was, it's only 1.1 degrees, which you expect when you come out of the little ice age, which we have. And then finally, just on the, without going too long, CO2 is absolutely critical to life. It's the most important gas on the planet. Now, reason I say that is because of CO2 that we get our oxygen. Yeah. We get it from photosynthesis. It doesn't come from anywhere else. We live because of CO2. The CO2 and the interaction with H2O, water and sunlight, creates the plants, quite a complex reaction, but it creates the plants' sugars and starch, and it releases oxygen. So CO2 is responsible to two things. First of all, our very existence because of oxygen. And secondly, it is responsible for providing the food and structure of plants, and hence of all human beings. No human being, no animal could survive without CO2, because without CO2, there'd be no photosynthesis. And without that, there's no plants. And without that, there's no food for animals and humans. And that's the beginning and end of it. And we haven't got enough CO2. The ideal CO2 for greening the planet is around about 1,200 to 1,500 parts per million. And we're only at 417.
And even if CO2 was an issue, my understanding is that humans make up for very little of it, that actually it's the Earth itself that has the bulk of that CO2. So even this idea that if it's bad, you have to tackle what humans are doing, that doesn't make any sense either.
No, because we need more of it. I mean, you know, CO2 is a tiny percentage of the atmosphere, 0.0417%. Absolutely minute. There is over 50 times more CO2 in the surface of the oceans than in the atmosphere. In the surface. You know, when you get temperature rises, it releases CO2 from the oceans. We desperately need more CO2, not less. Plants grow, wheat yields in Europe have gone up by over 100% since 1960 in direct correlation with the increase of CO2. And that's, if I can just explain that quickly for your listeners.
Yeah.
The reason for that is not only because it fertilizes the plant and provides their energy and greater biomass and their reproductive facility is much better, but also because they lose less water. And that's the key thing about the greening, because that's why China and Southern Africa are rejoicing in the spread of vegetation where they never thought it would ever happen. And the reason for that is water loss is considerably diminished. And the reason for that is because the openings in the plant leaves, called stomata, are closing down because they don't need so many to absorb CO2. The plant only uses its stomata to absorb CO2. If there's much more CO2, it needs less of these openings. And it's because of that that the water doesn't leach out. And that's miraculous. And it's incontestable. And that's what the Sahel, imagine what it's like. Imagine you're a farmer in Burkina Faso or somewhere, and you've had to go to the coastal regions, and they all did, and you're returning to your home and finding you can grow crops. I mean, it's wonderful.
When I look at first of all, there's the debate, the dialogue on this issue. But I'm wondering why, because there are a couple of things in society more and more as the last 5, 10 years, 15 years have gone on that you're not allowed to debate. You were involved back in part of that about the European Union. Again, that was a loony fringe idea. That was achieved. But certainly the debate on climate change is, again, another area that you cannot have a competing view. And I'm wondering how you have found that in the last 12 years, if you've stepped into that arena.
Oh, yeah. People tell me, Jeremy, it's a jolly good book, but you're wasting your time. And I got a bit of hate mail and very stupid mail when I first published the book. And anyone who puts their toe in this water, what happens is they try to destroy reputation. And it happens again and again and again. There's so many examples. One of the most famous scientists in the world on this subject is Professor Happer of Princeton University, leading professor at that famous university. And Greenpeace did a scam on him, pretending to be a Saudi oil company or something, and tried to con him into writing an article. And he refused to accept any money, and he wasn't caught by it. Not because he found out that they were a scam, because he just doesn't accept money. But it's a scandal, the thing, that people try to tear down the reputation of a great scientist. And that there are hundreds of examples. But it doesn't matter to me. I mean, they can say what they like. And they can say I've done horrible things with little boys or little girls. They can say what they like, because I am a retired lawyer. I've got a couple of clients still. But I'm 80. And they can say what they bloody well like. I couldn't care damn. But if I can get access to people who govern policy to make it clear that this is a terrible, terrible, terrible scam, then the poor and the people who are terribly affected by the cost of living and the cost of electricity, and people in the third world who are denied the opportunity of using fossil fuels to improve themselves and lift themselves out of poverty, that will be a good thing for them, and I would rejoice. My life would have been worthwhile.
Jeremy, I love your attitude, and if only we had more of that, the desire to do the right thing and ignoring the consequences, we would be in a much better place in society. Yeah, but can I, again, the costs that are talked about on this issue are phenomenal. Yeah. And I wonder, again, it's not as if we're going down a pathway that's easy and cheap, but it is going against our very human development and going against how we have got to this point in our history. And the costs are unbearable, really. So, I mean, tell us more about that.
Well, the cost, the actual cost of decarbonisation is just completely out of our reach. I mean, national grid last year in July published that they thought it would cost up to $3 trillion, which is 3,000 million. I mean, it's just ridiculous. But the real cost is a reversal of modern economy progress. I mean, if the cancelling fossil fuels will be the greatest harm that human civilization has ever suffered. It's the reason why, since 1850, the welfare has spread not just down but round the world in a way it's just impossible to have imagined in 1850. You know, 1850, the railways had just started, but people were dying of rickets and dying of bad teeth. And yeah, I mean, the state of affairs in Africa wasn't even discovered. It was appalling. People suffered terribly. And they've been lifted out of that, and not only out of poverty, but out of ignorance. Mm. And, you know, I rejoice that the cleverest man in America is the son of a former slave, Thomas Sowell. He is without doubt, in my opinion, the most clever and wise man in America. And the most clever and wise person in Africa for many years was Nelson Mandela. You know, I rejoice, just like I rejoice when Margaret Thatcher became prime minister, the greatest prime minister of peacetime we've ever, well, since Pitt or Peel. So, you know, it's simply appalling. You have no conception of the damage will be done by decarbonisation. It will reverse the progress of modern civilization. And it's intended to do. That's what it was intended to do by the people who started it off. You know, they said so.
Well, tell us more about this, the dogma, because it is pervading every area of society. It's a religious fervor that you must accept. Why has that been used? Why is it that intensity being used? How has it come to this point where it is an absolute dogma that you must accept?
I agree with that. I'm not going to pin my flag to saying how horrible they all are, therefore let's ignore them. It needs some sort of explanation. Yeah. I've thought about this hard for a long time. I think it's because human beings have found it really very difficult to adjust to the phenomenal change that has taken place since 1850. I mean, both in terms of power, electricity and that's that kind of thing, and steam power, but also the power of destruction, warfare, explosives, this colossal change, and the power of scientific discovery. I mean, it's just incredible. Einstein was a patent clerk. He wasn't a scientist. He discovered the most incredible theory in 1906, I think it was. You couldn't begin to explain what he was talking about to someone born in 1850. So I think human beings have found it very difficult to adjust to this. And they look in shock at this carnage of the 20th century and with the power of the weapons that we have now, the unlimited carnage and the cruelty of human beings. It's just inexplicable for them. And then you have this serious existential threat of nuclear weapons, which is hovering around now. Mm. So I think that there was a reaction, strong reaction. It starts in 1940s with a chap called Dr. Vogt, I think. It continues on until the late 60s when Rachel Carson wrote a book called Secret Spring or something, Silent Spring. But the real thing that got it going was the Club of Rome, where there was a group of people who were scientists and others who got together and formulated the notion that human race is its own greatest enemy. And population was getting out of control, resources were going to run out, there'll be millions of people swarming over the planet looking for food, looking for water, and catastrophe faced us. And that was picked up by a chap at Stanford University in the 1980s, a chap called Stephen Schneider, and also a fellow called, who's still alive, I think, Paul Ehrlich. And they made fantastic claims about what the future is going to hold. And they decided that the way to deal with this was to pick on an issue which was global and which could be used to frighten humanity into reversing its onward progress. And they were quite outspoken about it. There are a series of things that they wrote and expressed and said in the 1980s and 1990s. And they said, we'll be picked on CO2 because it's the one thing you could find which we could get at, because it is emitted by fossil fuels. If we stop that, we stop the onward rush of humanity's progress or growth, which they were condemning. They were entirely against the idea of growth. And that's what we're in now. And that's why it's what we're facing, and it's never been a scientific issue. Never. Mm. It's always been a political one. It's always been, we have the moral case. Doesn't matter too much about the science. We're right morally, and therefore, shut up.
And of course, one of the big drivers behind it is the UN through the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. So, yeah, I mean, tell us more about, because you have these big bodies that actually force, and all governments are, in effect, forced to sign up to their agenda.
Yeah, but you know, in a way, you can't blame the governments, but it was intended. The chap who set up this outfit was a chap called Maurice Strong. He was an extreme socialist, more than a socialist. But he was also president of a number of oil companies that made an absolute fortune out of oil, which is a bit of an ironical. You look him up, Maurice Strong. He only died in 2015. But he was a terrible man. He spent most of his life in China. He thought China was the ideal society. He set up the United Nations Environment Programme, and from that he engineered the setting up of this UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Well, it's nothing to do with investigating climate change. It's not that at all. What it's doing is showing that there is climate change and the human beings are causing it. That's all it's interested in. It's not interested in looking at the issue and saying, is there such a thing? So you're right. And he's very clever getting the UN. He was a deputy director general of the UN. So he had immense influence. And the point about this, Peter, is that when you've got a global body, it's got a global problem, a global catastrophe, a global issue, and a global reach. It's not national, so it's not dependent on anybody's vote. Nobody voted the UN into office at all. Nobody really knows who they are. They drag in so-called scientists, but when you look at it, they're not scientists at all. They're a lot of them nature conservators and general people who feel good about looking after the planet. But they're not scientists. But of course, governments bend the knee to it. It's much easier to do that. And of course, everybody wants to wave their arms with virtue signaling. The EU is worst of all, but look at the way that fool Johnson's behaved at Glasgow. What an idiot he is, talking about tea cozies. CO2 is a tea cozy. What a fool. There's no such thing. I mean, what a fool. Surely he's better advised than that. It's contemptible.
Well, maybe he's not better advised, but...
You're right, Peter.
No, one of the other fallacies in this is that even if the whole debate, even if the whole premise that the climate change was based on, if what we were being offered was a good society, a better way, then I mean you could go along with that. But if you look at the rejection of nuclear power completely outright, you look at the solar panels, again all made in China, we're now covering over our landscape instead of growing food, we're covering it over with that. I mean, and then you look at batteries and all the rare earth materials used, and then they don't know what to do with them. You've got so many issues that actually what they propose doesn't seem to lead to a better world at all.
I'm not saying we should have fossil fuels forever. I think we should get off them as soon as humanity can get off them without damaging itself. I've long said that. Hydrocarbons are far too valuable. But, you know, there really is plenty of it. and we need to use it until we can get something better. And the future must be nuclear for fixed energy generation, particularly if we can ever do fusion. And it's looking hopeful that. And I think the Japanese are probably going to do wonderful things there. I do hope so. And for transportable energy, well, there are various things. I do strongly favour hydrogen. But, you know, hydrogen can be converted into electricity with electrolysis. So, you know, there are many, many options. But they can't be knee-jerk, virtue signalling, look at me, I'm looking after the planet. No. You've got to look after people who can't look after themselves. You've got to look after people at the bottom of the pile. You've got to look after people in Africa who are struggling to even survive. You know, children are dying through lack of medical care and energy. That's what you've got to do. I think it's shocking. Mm. Virtue signaling is the most wicked thing because it diverts people from the truth. And, you know, the truth is very, very good. Humanity is on a very good track. You know, I know people are making war with each other, but there's a huge increase in spirituality and care for the planet and consciousness of our role and our duties to nature and to each other. It's a much better world than they will have you believe. It really is. I'm on the side of that.
One other thing I find there were in the book at the beginning, you have 46, just the beginning, different figures, different graphs, and how you show that. What has been the response when you have shown the data to people who should know better? How do they so easily dismiss the facts that you're showing to them?
If they don't. You see what happens is they bury it. But it's not, I mean, I have had some very tangible support from people who have been very complimentary about the book. And that's why I've been able to spread the message quite a bit. So that is true. But what they do is they bury it. They just don't want to see it. They don't want to look at it. It's just, no. We don't talk about that.
And again, this book has been published.
They'll talk about it in Westminster when we get the vote. That's why the Ukraine war, although it's not the cause of this price hike, the probable cause is many things, including the pandemic. But the appalling lies that are told about CO2 and climate change. It's so wicked because these people who just propagate this nonsense, they're not paying the price. You know who will pay the price. People who's heating their own bills are doubled. You know, they're paying the price. I just think it's so shameful. But it will come out. You know, Johnson won't survive net zero. I'm sure of that. I personally think, this is a personal view, I think the only option for the Conservatives and for the country for the moment is for David Frost to take a much bigger role than he has been doing, because he's got real gravitas, that chap. And I think he understands that net zero is ludicrous, absolutely ludicrous. You see, the fracking is a very simple thing. The fracking is a means by which you extract gas, which is being created by the deposit, calcium carbonate deposits over millennia, which reduce themselves down into their original carbon content, because that calcium carbonate was formed by she creatures who take carbon out of the atmosphere from carbon dioxide, which is absorbed in the water. And fracking is simply a way of extracting the gas that these creatures, you know, have very kindly provided for us over the past 300 million years. The idea that this is going to cause some sort of disturbance to houses, you know, it's just ludicrous. You know, I mean, supposing it did cause a whole street to collapse, it's just it's so far away from that happening. But supposing it did, you know, we're talking about wartime emergency here. We're talking about the need for this country to have stable, affordable, secure energy for its peoples.
Absolutely. Can I, if, just to finish off on, this has been published by the Bruges Group. Yes. And I give credit to Robert Oles for willing to engage with this. Exactly. There are not many organizations or groups that are willing to have this debate. And I'm wondering, how did you find it whenever you were talking about getting this information out? It is a perfect fit with the Bruges Group, but it is difficult to get the message out in that regards.
Oh, it's pathetic. You're quite right. I don't want to mention names, but even organizations which purport to be for free speech or purport to be helping on net zero, they won't touch it. It's terrible. You see, I mean, the fundamental reason why CO2 cannot cause temperature rise is that it's already saturated with infrared radiation. That means it can't absorb anymore. And it's been at that level ever since it got to 200 parts per million. Once you get more CO2, it can't saturate, it can't absorb it. It's like putting on a pair of sunglasses, you know. You want to put another pair of sunglasses to reduce this sunlight, and each one produces by 50%, until you get, you have, by the time you've got five sunglasses on it, it's not reducing it anymore. It's a logarithmic decline. And the wicked thing is that Stephen Schneider wrote an article in Science magazine in 1971, and he actually wrote down, this was before he got onto the Club of Rome bandwagon, he actually wrote to say CO2 is not a problem because it's saturated. It can't absorb more radiation. Maximum amount of more CO2, 1 degree by the end of the century. And he was spot on. I mean, it's 1.1 degree. It's impossible for CO2 to absorb more heat. I'll say that again. It is impossible, as a matter of physics, for CO2 to absorb more infrared radiation from the Earth's surface.
Wow. Jeremy, let's finish it on that. Let me once again bring up, there is the book Climate All Is Well, All Will Be Well, published 22nd of October 2021. The link will be in the description. And can I also bring up on Getter, you can find the link to the details of the event on Wednesday. It will be doors open 7 p.m. in Wallingford Town Hall. And it's a great event, and it's exciting to see a council wanting to discuss this and debate it. And this will be the first Winston Smith Literary Review lecture. And I know it will be the first of many, but you can go to Getter, and please do promote that. Please do like that. Please do share it. All the details are there, and it'll be a wonderful event. We will live stream it. But of course, if you're available up there near Oxford, then you can come along and be part of the evening itself and hear Jeremy. So Jeremy, thank you so much for your time. Fascinating, and looking forward to Wednesday.
Very kind, Peter. Thanks a lot.
Not at all. Let me just hold it. Let me just finish off with our viewers. As I said, this will be going out. It's on Wednesday. All the details are there. Please make use of it. Do share the video. It's such an important debate. It's one, as I said, we haven't touched on probably enough, and it's something that we need to. And I think doing this begins to rectify that. So thank you to our viewers for watching and our listeners for listening. And hopefully we'll see you on the Wednesday.
If you like what we do, sign up to our mailing list, donate, share, and subscribe to our many platforms at heartsofoak.org. Thank you for listening.